Last time we saw the traditional notion of non-contextuality, let me remind you of the sort of bigger picture. So I was arguing that one sense in which studying contextuality can be more fruitful than studying non-locality is that the kinds of experiments that give you proofs of contextuality are a much broader class. So I don't need space-like separation. And then the question was, can I have these other desiderata for a notion of non-classicality, like being able to subject it to direct experimental test, whether it constitutes a resource. So this lecture is mostly about how to take the notion of non-contextuality we saw last time and turn it into something that's not just about the interpretation of quantum theory, but about how to interpret any operational theory. So let me just remind you, this was the notion of non-contextuality from last time. So it concerned how to represent quantum measurements. And for instance, in the case where I had two measurements that had some vector in common, the response function that represented that vector was the same regardless of which context it was measured in, so which basis it was a part of. Good, so there's a few problems with this notion. I mentioned a few other definitions of it. But you'll notice that it only talked about projective measurements. And as you saw in Joe Armisen's course, the most general notion of a measurement is a positive operator valued measure. It was totally silent about how to model those. But in fact, if I go to the lab, I never achieve the ideal of a projective measurement. Every measurement is slightly noisy. So every measurement in reality is represented by a POVM, not a projective measurement. So if you want to go and have an experimental test of some operational notion of non-contextuality, even if you're going to assume quantum theory, you need to know what to say about non-projective measurements. It was also the case that this assumed that the hidden variable model assigned outcomes deterministically. So these response functions only took values in 0 and 1, which meant that you were assuming that the ontic state completely determined the outcome of the measurement. And we saw in Bell's theorem that you didn't need to assume this deterministic, you didn't need to assume determinism to find that you had to derive the contradiction. You could derive it from locality alone. And so that's a kind of deficiency of the Cochen-Specker theorem relative to Bell's theorem, that you did need to assume this determinism. And then finally, the definitions were all given in terms of quantum concepts. It was about the representation of projective measurements. And so unlike Bell's notion of local causality, where you could say of any operationally well-defined theory, you know, is it locally causal or not? Here, it seems like you can only ask the question for the traditional notion about whether quantum theory is non-contextual or not. So you would like something, it would be nice to have a notion of non-contextuality that fixes those problems. And so this lecture is going to be about an operational notion of non-contextuality, which applies not just to quantum theory, but to any operational theory. And you can try to answer the question of whether that theory admits of a non-contextual model. And in particular, if you just give me some experimental data, you need a notion that can tell you whether a non-contextual model exists for that data. That's what we're trying to do. And I'll call it generalized non-contextuality. So let me remind you of what the ontological models framework looks like. You start with an operational theory, which is this minimalist thing where it just says, it prescribes what the distribution over outcomes or values of an outcome variable is for every choice of measurement procedure and preparation procedure that's allowed in your theory. And then an ontological model, I got the clicker and I'm not using it. Why am I not using it? There we go. An ontological model presumes that all these correlations can be explained by imagining that there's a particle that or a system that traverses between these guys. It has some physical state, we've been calling that the ontic state. And in the language of causation, it's this ontic state that causally mediates between the preparation and the measurement. So the reason, for example, that the statistics here can vary as I vary the choice of preparation procedure, according to these models, is that the preparation procedure influences the distribution over ontic states, which then influences the statistics of the outcome. So that's the idea of these models. And then we saw that every preparation procedure should be represented by some distribution over the ontic states. Every measurement procedure should be represented by some set of response functions that tell me the probability, say this is outcomes 1, 2, and 3, the probability of each outcome for every ontic state. And it can be indeterministic. You can give non-zero probabilities for many different outcomes. And then finally, you recover the operational statistics with this formula. So we saw this in one of the early lectures. Okay, so here's the idea of this generalized notion of non-contextuality. So first of all, so the type of thing that can be non-contextual or contextual is going to be an ontological model of a particular operational theory. So if you take quantum theory as your operational theory, and then you hand me a number of different models of it, like we saw some in tutorial, there was the Bell-Merman model, the Cochin-Specker model, and so forth. For every one of them, you can answer the question, is it a non-contextual model or not? But that's just like a ontological model can be locally causal or not, it's the model that's going to be non-contextual or not. And the idea of this definition, this is just to sort of to give you a feel for what it means, is that if you have two experimental procedures that are operationally equivalent, and I'm going to specify what that means in a moment, then you should represent them in the same way in the ontological model. So roughly speaking, the idea is that if things look the same at an operational level, then it's because they are the same at the ontological level. Okay, so this is, let me tell you what precisely this means. So I'm going to start with cases where the experimental procedure is a preparation. So suppose you've got some theory, some operational theory. It allows you to do, for a given system, all sorts of different preparations of it. So we might be talking about quantum theory, and the polarization degree of freedom of a photon, and all of these could be different ways of preparing the polarization degree of freedom of a photon. So you could pass it through a polarizer, you could rotate the polarizer, you can do all sorts of things. And so I just imagine in any operational theory, I'm going to have this. I'm going to have a whole battery of possible ways of preparing the system, and similarly, a whole bunch of different ways of measuring that same degree of freedom. So if you, every operational theory will have this sort of thing. And then you can start getting some structure. You can start organizing the preparation procedures into equivalence classes. So the notion of equivalence I have in mind here is equivalence with respect to the statistics of all measurements. So what I mean is this. Suppose I take this procedure, I put it in front of M1, and I run it for a long time, and I calculate the statistics of the different outcomes. Okay. Then I put it in front of M2, and I calculate the statistics of outcomes on N2, and so on for all the guys. And I have this big table of data that all characterizes P1. And then I do the same thing for P4. Put it in front of every measurement procedure, calculate all the statistics. If I find that the statistics for these guys are the same for all the measurements, then it means that even though the details of those devices might be very different, from the perspective of what they predict about future experimental results, they're exactly the same. So in particular, if I took one of these, put it inside a black box, and all you got out of it was the system, and you got to do any measurement you liked on it, you couldn't tell me which one of these two procedures was inside the black box. So that's what I mean by operational equivalence. So I can organize all the preparation procedures into operational equivalence classes. I'm going to denote it by this symbol here. So P and P prime are operationally equivalent. Here's the technical definition. If, for all measurements in the operational theory, the distribution over the outcome of that measurement is the same for preparation P as for preparation P prime. All right. So what's this distinction is a distinction of equivalence class. It means you have different statistics. And any distinctions that are left over, distinctions in the details of the preparation procedure that don't ultimately make a difference for the statistics of any measurement, we'll call that a difference of context. Okay, so now I'm defining a more general notion of context than we had last lecture. Now context is going to be any way that I might change the procedure that doesn't ultimately change any operational statistics down the line. So here's a simple example. If I'm preparing the polarization of a photon, say, vertically polarized by using a piece of Polaroid, or whether I'm doing it by using a birefringent crystal and then blocking one of the outcomes, ultimately, I won't be able to tell the difference, right? Those are details of this procedure, which relative to quantum mechanics are irrelevant, right? They both get represented by exactly the same density operator at the end of the day. But this notion holds even if we're not in the quantum context. So let me just give you quantum theory as an example. So in quantum theory, if I have two different equivalence classes, then they have to be represented by different density operators. And that's because different equivalence classes will always differ in the statistics they predict for some measurement. And in quantum theory, that means that the density operators have to be different. If two density operators are going to make different predictions for some measurement, then they have to be different. Whereas this kind of difference, just a difference of context, can happen in various ways, like this polarization versus birefringent crystal case. But there are more interesting ways in which it can happen. So for instance, suppose this device flips a coin and prepares either the zero or the one state with equal probability. So we characterize that by the density operator identity over two. This device is different. It flips a coin and it prepares either the plus or the minus state. So those are very different things, different devices. But at the end of the day, because they both get represented by this same mixed state, no matter what measurement I do, I won't be able to tell whether you prepared the first ensemble or the second ensemble. So which pure state ensemble decomposes the complete mixed state? That's an example of a preparation context. It's a detail about the preparation that you cannot infer from the statistics of any future measurement. Good. So now we can finally define what a preparation non-contextual model is. It just says for all the preparations in a given equivalence class, they should be represented by precisely the same distribution over the ontic states. So the idea here is that a natural explanation of why none of these measurements can tell the difference between these two procedures is because maybe, remember, we're assuming that the outcomes of these measurements are being determined, perhaps probabilistically, by the ontic state that propagates between them, you know, the physical properties of the system that comes out of this device and goes into this one. So if it's the case that these two procedures end up sampling the ontic state from exactly the same distribution, then of course, you know, every measurement is going to have exactly the same statistics. So it's sort of an inference to the best explanation as to why you can't tell the difference between those guys. That, you know, any differences in the details of these procedures actually doesn't translate in such a model into differences in the distribution of the physical states. Now this is, as I said, a natural explanation, but it's not the only logical possibility. So it could be that, in fact, the distribution over the ontic states is different for these two preparation procedures. That's possible. And it's just that none of these measurement procedures are somehow refined enough to see that difference. So if it was the case that when I combine the statistics from all these measurement procedures, I still am unable to distinguish these sorts of details, then I could certainly model these two preparation procedures in this sort of way. But that's a very restrictive condition on the measurements, that I'm saying not just that no individual measurement can tell me everything about the physical states, but even having the statistics from all possible measurements does not allow me to figure out what the ontic state is. So it means sort of that the response functions of all these guys do not form a basis for the set of functions on this space, that there's some irreducible uncertainty that you'll have. So that's a logical possibility. And if that's what's going on, then you say that this is preparation contextual. Differences in these details, differences in context do get represented as differences in the distribution over the ontic states. So questions about that? Clear? All right. Let me give you an example. So suppose we have just the completely mixed state, which we're preparing by using a mixture of these two guys or a mixture of these two guys. Standard example. So you'll remember this psi complete model that David went over in the tutorial on ontological models. Where you just say, the projective Hilbert space, the surface of the block ball, that's the ontic state space, and you represent this operational state preparing the quantum state zero by a delta function at the North Pole. This guy is just a delta function at the South Pole, similarly with these guys. And so if this is the pure state ensemble you're preparing, then what you know about the ontic state is with probability half this delta function, with probability half that delta function. Whereas if this is the pure state ensemble, then it's this distribution. And of course, they're different distributions. Now it happens that these two different distributions predict the same probabilities for all the response functions that are allowed in the psi-complete model. So the response function in the psi-complete model are a subset of all possibilities. You know, you can't learn where you are on the block sphere in that model. And so these end up giving you exactly the same statistics, but they're different distributions. So one and the same density operator in this model gets represented by two different distributions. So it's a preparation contextual model. If, on the other hand, I take this psi epistemic model that we talked about a few lectures back, then these two states get represented by uniform distributions on two of the four ontic states. These two guys get represented by these two other distributions. But when I take the uniform mixture of these two or the uniform mixture of these two, I get the same distribution. So here, the distribution that represents the complete mixed state is the same regardless of whether it is realized by this ensemble or this ensemble. And that's a preparation non-contextual model. It says this difference of which ensemble I used, which doesn't have any impact on the statistics, is explained by the fact that that distinction ends up not mattering to the distribution over which I sampled these ontic states. All right, so that's it for preparation non-contextuality. Now let me define measurement non-contextuality. So this is going to connect more to what we saw last time, because last time it was all about the representation of measurements. So it's very similar to what we saw for the preparations. I can organize all my measurement procedures into operational equivalence classes, where now the notion of operational equivalence is that they should give the same statistics on all preparation procedures in your operational theory. So M is operational equivalent to M prime if for all preparations, the statistics of outcome of M are exactly the same as the statistics of outcomes of M prime. Okay, so again, any differences in the experimental procedure that I'm implementing that do not change the equivalence class I'm in, I'm going to call a difference of context. So now this is what a measurement context is. So here's an example from quantum theory. If this measurement device measures this basis of a three-dimensional Hilbert space and then coarse grains these two outcomes into one outcome, and this device measures this other basis, which agrees on psi 1, and then it coarse grains these two outcomes, at the end of the day, they're both measuring just the projector value measure, which is the projector on psi 1, versus the identity minus the projector on psi 1. And that means that they're going to give exactly the same statistics for all preparation procedures. All density operators are going to give the same probability distribution of these guys. They only differ by how I'm decomposing this rank 2 projector. It's very similar to what we saw with the preparations, where the choice of pure state ensemble is a difference in how you decompose the completely mixed state. It's the same sort of thing here. So the notion of measurement non-contextuality just says, whenever you have two measurement procedures that are operational equivalent, represent them by the same set of response functions. So if we assume these are binary outcome measurements, there's a pair of response functions. They don't have to be deterministic, but they have to be the same for these two guys. That's a measurement non-contextual model. But it's not logically necessary. It could be that these two things are represented by different sets of response functions. But for that to work, it has to be the case that that this distinction cannot be observed even with the combined statistics of how these respond to all preparation procedures. So there has to be constraints on the distribution over the ontic states such that the possible distributions you get out of any procedure ultimately don't form a basis of the set of the space of functions, because it can't give you any insight into whether it's this or this. So that would be a measurement contextual model, and it's a logical possibility. Let me just mention one other thing, which is that now that we have these general definitions, the examples I've used are sort of the familiar ones, but there's many other examples you can provide. So for example, here, If I have a POVM representing these two guys, then there's often many ways of implementing a given POVM. I can find a mixture of projective measurements, many different mixtures of projective measurements that give the same POVM. Or you might remember the Neumark extension, where you measure POVM by coupling your system to an ancilla by a unitary and then doing a projective measurement on the whole. That means that that's yet another way of measuring the same POVM, you know, which Neumark extension you use. So all those kinds of different ways of measuring a given POVM would all correspond to notions of measurement context here. And similarly, over on the preparation side, which pure state ensemble you use is not the only type of preparation context. You could also say, well, what if I prepare this density operator by preparing an entangled state on a larger system and then tracing out the ancilla? That's yet another way of preparing the same density operator. That's an example of a preparation context. Preparation architecturality says your ontological representation of that should not depend on how you've implemented it. Okay, so the spirit is that if you've got these operational equivalents of preparations, then you should represent them by the same distributions over the ontic states. Operational equivalents of measurements means they're represented by the same sets of response functions. And the slogan is that when you see context independence at the operational level, meaning no dependence of your statistics on certain details of the experimental procedures, like which pure state ensemble you used, you know, which particular coarse graining of a basis you used, then it's because you have context independence at the ontological level. That's the idea. Okay, there's just a couple of notes here. There's also a notion for transformations, and I'm not going to go into it. And I would say that although you can make distinctions among these notions, the only really natural assumption to make is what I'll call universal non-contextuality, which is just assume it for all procedures. Because it's the same conceptual idea that you're saying, look, this context independence at the operational level implies context independence at the ontological level. If you're going to deny it in one sphere, then you may as well just deny it everywhere. If you don't think it's natural for measurements, maybe you don't think it's natural for preparations, but it really doesn't make sense to assume it for one kind of procedure and not for the others. So to my mind, the only natural assumption to make is this assumption for all procedures. Okay, so that's it for the definition. Now I can talk about how to use this to derive non-contextuality inequalities, which will be like Bell inequalities. They constrain the statistics of an experiment. There are a set of inequalities that tell you if your statistics satisfy these, then your experiment can admit of a non-contextual model, and if they violate it, it can't. Now, I could have given you, if I had more time, I could have shown you that operational quantum theory, for example, fails to be preparation non-contextual. So I can derive a no-go theorem that says, if you take the idealized predictions of operational quantum theory, you can show, just like in the Cochin-Specker theorem, that there's no way of representing the predictions with a universally non-contextual model. But that would have the same sort of, I mean, that's fine, but the problem that we were trying to solve today is, you know, how do I, instead of having a no-go theorem for interpretations of quantum theory, how do I get a result that says, let me go to the lab and test whether this principle of non-contextuality holds for whatever theory describes the universe. Like, we want a result that says, even if quantum theory turns out to be false tomorrow and replaced by some other theory, if we have a notion of non-contextuality that we can test directly, then we can say, well, any successor to quantum theory is still going to have to fail the principle of non-contextuality, and so we're going to have to build that into all those theories. That's what I'm going to focus on today, just trying to derive inequalities directly from this new notion that I've defined. And so I'm going to start with a very simple case where you use only the notion of preparation non-contextuality, and you don't worry, you don't use the notion of measurement non-contextuality at all. Okay, so the simplest way of doing this involves a small departure relative to the conceptual scheme we've been using before. So up till now, we've been focusing on preparation procedures. And remember, a preparation procedure, like I've drawn one here, it's a box, you know, maybe I can choose different settings, but it has no outcome. And I'm going to switch to talking about sources. So I get the term sources from quantum information theory, where if, for example, I'm talking about the input to a quantum channel, I could imagine a device that randomly chooses a quantum state to put in the channel and outputs a classical record of which quantum state it chose. So it has an output. It might say, the output's zero. The classical outcome is zero. And that prepares state row on the quantum system. If the classical outcome is one, that prepares state sigma. And it just keeps a classical record of which state it's prepared. So it's really a whole ensemble of states. And it's not, it's not under your control which of those quantum states gets prepared on the output. You just learn which state gets prepared by looking at the classical outcome. I've tried to draw a little cartoon of what it might look like inside that box. You could, roll some dice, for example, or flip a coin. For one outcome, you do one preparation, and you take the output, and you bring it out of the box. For the other outcome, you do some other preparation, take its quantum output, and bring it outside the box. And then for the classical outcome of this whole procedure, you just report how the coin came up, which of these two procedures you actually implemented. So how do you represent that in an ontological model? Well, it's just going to be now a conditional probability of lambda, the ontic state of the physical system that comes out, and S, the classical outcome, given the description of which source you're talking about, or maybe some variable that determines which source you're implementing. So lambda describes this output, S is the classical outcome, and capital S is the setting variable. And of course, now if I sum over all the ontic states and over all the outcomes, I expect this to be normalized. And I expect correlations between them. As for different classical outcomes, I get different distributions over the ontic states. So I'm making this shift because I'm ultimately going to leverage a connection with Bell's theorem, and now my preparations are going to look a lot more like a measurement, because they're going to have an outcome. You'll see in a minute how this works. So first of all, let me note that every source defines a preparation procedure which I get when I average over the outcomes. So this little ground symbol from electronics I'm going to use to mean you got an outcome, and then you just ignored it, right? So that corresponds, quantum mechanically to taking the average of the density operators in the ensemble corresponding to the source, weighted by their probabilities. In this ontological model, it's going to correspond to just marginalizing over the classical outcome, so just sum over all the possibilities. And that just gives me some fixed distribution over the ontic states for each choice of the setting variable. All right, and now here's the key thing that I'm going to use, which is that if you give me two different sources, but the average preparation that they define is operationally equivalent, okay, then the distribution over the ontic states is going to be the same for those two sources in a preparation non-contextual model. So like our example where one source might prepare the zero and the one quantum states with equal probability, the other source might prepare the plus and the minus quantum states with equal probability. If I don't register the outcome, both those sources correspond to preparations of the complete mixed state. So then I would have that operational equivalence, and I would say that, whatever the overall representation of each of those sources are, the representation of the average preparation they define has to be the same distribution over the ontic states. And so that's very much like that picture where we had here I'll show you, I'll go back to it. In the psi epistemic model, where we just had a single distribution here, single distribution corresponding to complete mixed states, and the only difference between the two sources would be whether it decomposes into this pair or this pair when I condition on its classical outcome. But if I don't condition on that outcome, it's just some fixed distribution. All right, I think that's all the preliminary stuff I need, and now I've shifted my notation slightly for, you'll see why later, but if I have, a set of possible sources and a set of possible measurements, and I'm trying to compute the correlations between them. So now you'll see why I've chosen to use sources rather than preparations. Now, things look a bit like the sorts of expressions we see in Bell's theorem, where we're looking at correlations between two outcomes given possible pairs of settings. So instead of having two measurements on a bipartite system, I have a source with a measurement doing measurements on it, but I can still talk about the correlations between the outcome of the source and the outcome of the measurement. So this looks just like the types of things you see in Bell inequalities. And this is the expression for them, right? So the measurement is represented in the ontological model by the probability of getting a particular outcome given what measurement you've done, given the ontic state. And the source was represented as the probability of getting a particular ontic state coming out and a particular classical outcome given the setting of the source. Now, here's the key trick. If I just use a Bayesian inversion, so this is just a part of classical probability theory, I can bring lambda to the right-hand side of the conditional. So this joint probability is equal to the probability of the outcome given lambda in the setting times the probability of lambda given the setting. Okay, so this is just a fact from classical probability theory. But if I presume that all of these sources, when I ignore the outcome, give me the same average preparation, then preparation on contextuality guarantees that the distribution is independent of which of the sources, so I'll just call it nu of lambda. And therefore, this term here, which you might have thought would depend on the setting, does not. It just depends on lambda. Okay? So that tells you that the correlations will have this kind of form. All right, so what's special about that form? Well, that turns out to be precisely the form of correlations that you can use to derive Bell inequalities. So we didn't go over this in the Bell inequality lecture, but we almost got there. So I mentioned that the Bell experiment, which looks like this, can always be modeled in this causal models framework as specify a distribution over lambda here, specify a conditional for this variable given its parents, x given lambda s, a conditional for y given lambda and t, its parents, and the overall probability of the two outcomes given two possible settings is just this product summed over lambda. So maybe you saw this in a tutorials. Can't remember. Yeah, you did. Okay, so this is what people usually focus on. This is the mathematical starting point of derivations of Bell inequalities. Once you have this formula, you know that the statistics you observe are going to satisfy Bell inequalities. So I can derive CHSH inequality starting from this constraint. But if I look at the form of this, it's exactly what we just derived, right? It's some distribution over a variable times a probability of an outcome given the local set. So the outcome here given that setting and the hidden variable, and a probability of the outcome here given a setting and the hidden variable. The only difference is that this probability now has to be interpreted as a retrodiction. It's saying, what should I infer about what the outcome was in the past, given that I know that the ontic state that came out of the device was lambda, and given that I know that the setting was capital SI. So in the Bell case, this probability was an inference to the future, right? What will the outcome Y be given that the ontic state I feed into the device is lambda and the setting is T? But that doesn't matter for the mathematical properties of this equation. So this satisfies precisely the same constraints as in the Bell setting. And that means that these sorts of correlations we see here will satisfy the Bell inequalities. So the bottom line is I can get all these interesting constraints here, but instead of any sort of notion of local causality, I have made an assumption of preparation non-contextuality, and I've used sources that have this special property that all of the average preparations they define are the same. Okay, so in particular, suppose I have this really simple setup where I have a source, I'll call the setting variable S, the outcome X, a measurement, setting variable T, outcome Y, and it has this feature that if I ignore, say for two different values of the setting variable, if I ignore the outcome, I get things that are operationally equivalent. So this is exactly like the Bell setup we focused in on. These are all binary variables. It's exactly like the Bell setup. And so I can define the same sort of game. I can say when the settings are 0, 0 or 0, 1 or 1, 0, I want the outcomes to agree. And when the two settings are 1 and 1, I want the outcomes to disagree. So let's say that's the game we're playing. This is the probability that you win the game. All the same analysis we did before carries through, because ultimately all that really mattered for our analysis of that situation was that it was common cause, which meant that this formula held. And that formula holds in this context as well, or a formula of the same form. So we get the same sort of constraint that you can prove that for this prepare and measure scenario, the probability of getting these kinds of correlations is at most 3/4, like we saw last time. But again, in quantum mechanics, you can violate that. So you do the precise analog of what we did in Bell. You say, suppose this measurement is of this basis and this basis for each of the two values of the same variable. And now suppose that this source generates this ensemble or this ensemble. So it prepares each of the z eigenstates of this qubit with equal likelihood if the setting is 0, and the outcome just tells me which of the two I've prepared. Whereas if the setting is 1, it prepares each of these two eigenstates with equal likelihood. So in that setup, you showed that the probability of getting this pattern of correlations we talked about is 85%. That's the precise analog of Bell. But now it's an experimental scenario that doesn't involve any space-like separation. It makes a different assumption. It's not assuming the principle of local causality. It's assuming that your ontological explanation is preparation non-contextual. That's what goes into driving this inequality. So the fact that we can violate that quantum theory, that inequality in quantum theory, means that quantum theory does not admit of a preparation non-contextual ontological model. Questions about that? All right, few notes. In the Bell experiment, we had the possibility of changing what the entangled state was. So we got that 85% success probability when this thing was a maximally entangled state. And there's a number of results that say if you don't have enough entanglement, you can't violate a Bell inequality. What's the analog of all that? Well, if I'd put a transformation procedure between the source and the measurement, that ultimately plays the same role as this entangled state. So we presume that that was an identity channel. Had we made it a unitary, I could have still achieved, by appropriate choice of the source and the measurement, I could have still achieved that maximum value of 85%. But if I imagine that this thing decoheres the qubit a little bit, that's the analog of saying this isn't maximally entangled. And the more decoherence I add at some point, I'm not going to be able to violate that inequality anymore. I'm going to go below 75%. All right, so one final point about this, which is there's a very tight connect. I mean, I've presented to you an example of preparation contextuality that's very closely connected to Bell's theorem. And here's another way of seeing the connection, which is suppose I take the Bell experiment, but I just think of all of this here as a preparation of the system that gets fed into the right-hand device. So there's two choices of the setting variable on the measurement here. Think of that as a choice of the setting for this source. And the outcome is just the outcome of this source. It's people sometimes call this steering. I prepare this system by doing a particular kind of measurement on his entangled partner and then recording the outcome. So this is a perfectly valid way of implementing a source. And the fact that I can't signal, so the choice of setting here cannot influence the statistics of any measurement over here, means that if I ignore the outcome of this source, I'm going to find that for each of the values of the setting variable, they're operationally equivalent, because no measurement that I do on this black box can tell the difference between different choices of setting here. If it could, then it means I could use it to signal. So the assumption of operational equivalence of sources in this particular case is justified by the assumption of no signaling. And in this particular case, the assumption of local causality implies that the distribution over the ontic states here also have to be independent of S, which is precisely the conclusion I would have gotten by applying preparation non-contextuality to these two sources, right? If the average preparation for the two is the same, then I expect that the distribution over the ontic states should be the same. So here I can justify preparation non-contextuality by local causality. But also I can say for these sorts of scenarios, local causality is a kind of preparation non-contextuality. It's a special case of preparation non-contextuality for sources that have this form. So this is the sense in which the notion of a universally non-contextual ontological model is broader than the notion of a locally causal model. It subsumes that notion, so it's a special case, but it also implies more constraints. So for some people, you know, only local causality, they want to assume only local causality because they think that this broader application of non-contextuality is not as sound, right? It's not as plausible, that the only really plausible way instance of non-contextuality is the case when it's justified by local causality. But others look at this and say, well, no, it's the same intuition in both cases, and so we should assume the broader form of this principle and not just the local form. All right. Any questions? I'm going to move on now to measurement non-contextuality, but any questions about this? No? All right. So I define this operational notion of measurement non-contextuality. The first thing I want to do is compare it to the one we saw yesterday. So in the language that I set up today, yesterday's notion would look like this. It would say, if two measurements are operationally equivalent, so that they differ only in measurement context, then I should represent them by the same set of response functions, but those response functions should be deterministic. That was really key, that the only thing that the outcome of the measurements can depend upon is the ontic state of the system, and they're determined, they're fixed deterministically by that ontic state. Whereas the notion that I defined today allows that these responses are not deterministic. That's really the only difference. And therefore, it means that this traditional notion we talked about yesterday can really be thought of as the conjunction of what I called measurement non-contextuality, together with this extra assumption that the outcomes are fixed deterministically by the ontic state. The kinds of NOGO theorems we saw yesterday, if I phrase them in the language we saw today, where you know what's important about the structure of the sets of quantum measurements we saw was the fact that there's certain operational equivalence relations in them. Like when we looked at the Perez-Merman square, it didn't matter for a particular observable whether I measure it as part of a row or as part of a column. That's an example of an operational equivalence in the language that we talked about today. And so what we saw yesterday was that if I assume that traditional notion and a bunch of those equivalents, you can derive a contradiction. And so given that the traditional notion is this pair, I can just write it this way. If I assume measurement non-contextuality together with this determinism assumption, together with the structure of the proof, I can derive a contradiction. Now, I think we talked a little bit about this yesterday, which is that in the face of this contradiction, you could try to salvage the spirit of non-contextuality, this thing, by giving up on determinism and saying, well, maybe the problem is not with the idea that the outcomes of the measurements are fixed by properties of the particle that fed into them. Maybe the problem was just assuming that they were fixed deterministically by those guys. Okay? This is, I mentioned, one of the problems with the traditional notion. So you can fix this. I'm going to show you how. And the idea is that there was something right about assuming that for projective measurements, the outcomes should be fixed deterministically. And that's because projective measurements have a certain operational property, that there exist preparation procedures that make their outcomes perfectly predictable. To have that property, I need them to have deterministic responses to the ontic states. But if we want to have a notion of non-contextuality that we can test experimentally, we need to turn, you know, instead of saying, what's the analog of the quantum property of being a projective measurement, we should just go and appeal directly to the predictability of the measurements that we're interested in. So if I want to say a certain measurement is responding deterministically to the ontic states I feed into it, I need to justify that by saying, oh, look, and the measurement is perfectly predictable in certain circumstances. That's the kind of strategy we're going to take. And we're going to say if a measurement's not perfectly predictable, but close to perfectly predictable, well, then that means maybe it depends indeterministically on the ontic state, but it can't have too much indeterminism. It needs to be close to deterministic. So let me just point out for this case, the 18-ray proof that we talked about. We noticed that there was no assignment, non-contextual assignment of values 0 and 1 to all the rays that appear in the proof. such that every quadruple has a single value one and many zeros. But if I say, oh no, I can have indeterministic assignments, then for example, I could assign probability half to each of these guys and have consistency. So the idea here is that if I do, say, you know, this measurement, so this is, I'm drawing a particular ontic state, and it says, if I do this measurement, I'll definitely get this outcome and not these three. If I do this measurement on that ontic state, then with probability half, I'll get this outcome. With probability half, I'll get that outcome. So it's not fixed deterministically by the ontic state. But now there's no contradiction, because if you look at every quadruple, the probabilities assigned to the four nodes all add up to one. So the point is that there are no non-contextual deterministic assignments, but there are non-contextual indeterministic assignments to those same sets of rays. And therefore, if you assume only measurement non-contextuality, so you say, well, I want my assignments to be non-contextual, but they're allowed to be indeterministic, I can't derive a contradiction, right? There's one, and there's many others, right? So it's fine. And so the only way you can get back to a no-go theorem is by appealing to preparation non-contextuality. So all the old proofs of the traditional notion of non-contextuality can be turned into no-go results for universal non-contextuality, but they all rely on preparation non-contextuality. They cannot rely only on measurement non-contextuality. Okay, so I'll give you one example of how you can derive non-contextuality inequalities. This is pretty recent stuff. In a way that uses measurement non-contextuality in some non-trivial way. So, first of all, I need to give you now an operational definition of joint measurability. When we were in the quantum context yesterday and I said, imagine two measurements can be implemented jointly, we knew what that meant. We said, oh, well, the observables are going to commute. That's what it means to be able to measure them jointly. But now we want to do this totally operationally. We want to say, I have a theory. It doesn't have to be quantum theory. What does it mean in a general operational theory to say that two measurements can be implemented jointly? What does it mean to have things that are compatible? I'm aiming to generalize the Merman magic square example, so I need a notion of compatibility. So suppose you have this situation where you have a measurement M1 and you want to say it's compatible with M2 and it's compatible with M3, but they're not compatible with one another. How can we make sense of that operationally? So the idea is to understand it in terms of the ability to simulate both of those measurements with a single procedure. So suppose I have a procedure here, I'll call it M12. So if M1 had an outcome K1 and M2 had an outcome K2, M12 has a pair of outcomes, K1 and K2. And if I ignore the K1 outcome of this measurement device, this thing behaves exactly the same as the M2 device that you started with, meaning on all preparation procedures, the statistics of this guy look exactly the same as the statistics of this guy. And similarly, if I ignore outcome K2 of this, I get something that's operationally equivalent to M1. So that's what I mean by M1 and M2 are compatible. And that's the case for quantum measurements as well. If you say I have a Hermitian operator A and a Hermitian operator B, and they commute, right? Let's say they both say it's on a four-dimensional Hilbert space, and they both have binary outcomes, then all I need to do is find the four outcome measurement, which is the basis that jointly diagonalizes A and B, do that measurement, and then I just ignore whichever outcome. So I coarse grain those four basis vectors into two pairs of two to get the eigenspaces of B, or I coarse grain it another way to get the eigenspaces of A. So this is exactly the same as the notion from quantum theory. But I haven't had to use the quantum formalism at all. This is well defined in any operational theory. So if you have an operational theory, you can just ask, in my operational theory, is there any measurement that exists that has the property of simulating both M1 and M2 by processing its outcomes? And then you can do the same thing for M1 and M3. You can say, is there a measurement which, if I ignore its second outcome, I get something that's equivalent to him? If I ignore the first outcome, I get something equivalent to him. If so, then M3 and M1 are jointly measurable. Okay, so now we have this operational notion of joint measurability. This difference now, you know, whether I measured M1 this way or this way, is precisely a difference of measurement context. So in Prez-Merman, we said, this observable, do I measure it together with this set of commuting observables or this other set? This is the operational analog of it. How am I simulating this guy, this way or this way? All right. So let's take the Perez-Mermin square and let's try to make it totally operational. So remember, it was this set of 9 Hermitian operators. So now I've written in the tensor products explicitly, because it's going to be helpful. So they commute in every row and every column. And they have the property that the outcomes of a triple that commute, like say the first row, well, every one of them has eigenvalues plus or minus 1. So each measurement has just 2 possible outcomes, plus or minus 1. But if I take the product of the 3 operators, I get identity, which means whatever 3 outcomes I get, the products of those 3 values have to be 1. The only eigenvalue of identity is 1. And the only exception is the 3rd column, where the products of the outcomes of those 3 measurements has to be minus 1. So we mentioned that in a non-contextual model, any values I want to assign to all those 9 measurements, first of all, have to be the same regardless of the context. So this is how I'm now denoting the value from ontic state lambda to X tensor I, and it's the same value as appears over here. And the products of those values have to give me exactly what I wanted before. So that's how we got the contradiction last time, because you can't satisfy these equations. So now we generalize. We say it's no longer the case that I have quantum measurements. I just have 9 binary outcome measurements in some operational theory. And now I want to presume that they're jointly measurable along the rows and along the columns. So let's consider the first row. That means that there has to exist some measurement with a pair of outcomes that simulates these 3 guys in this particular way. So here, remember, in this, it wasn't just that they were jointly measurable. They had this very particular feature. So let me explain this a bit more carefully. Suppose I do a measurement where I do poly x on the first qubit and poly x on the second qubit, and I keep both outcomes. So that's a measurement whose outcome variable is got cardinality 4, right? Because I have a bit here and a bit here. And then if I do that, I can say, well, let me just ignore the second bit, the second outcome. That gives me this measurement. And what if I just ignore the first outcome? That gives me this measurement. But if I take the product of those 2 binary outcomes, I get this guy, right? So if the x measurements I did on the 2 qubits were either both plus or both minus, then this guy has the value plus 1. If they were plus minus or minus plus, this guy has the value minus 1. So there's a particular kind of simulation that holds between them. The measurement that simulates all 3 of them has the property that to get each one, I either ignore the second outcome, ignore the first, or take the product of the 2 outcomes. So all these outcomes are assumed to be plus or minus 1. And I'll denote taking the product this way. So that's what we saw in the quantum case. So I'm just going to generalize that. I'm going to say whatever the operational theory is, imagine we have 3 measurements. They're jointly measurable. And this guy is the product, this guy's ignoring the first, this guy's ignoring the second. Okay? So now I can do the same thing for the other columns and rows. So if you look at the first column, again, it's ignore the second outcome, ignore the first, or take their product to simulate these 3 guys. And now here's, you know, we get our example of a measurement context. I can measure this, I can implement this measurement either this way or that way. The assumption of measurement non-contextuality says the way I represent it should be independent of how I've done it, because these are operationally equivalent by assumption. So I'm assuming that my operational theory has this structure, that there's these measurements and they are operationally equivalent in this particular way. So you can fill it in. You can say for each row, I have to have a measurement that simulates everything on that row. For each column, there has to be a measurement that simulates everything on that column. And notice that over here in the third column, you take the product and then you multiply by minus 1. Because in the quantum example, that's what we saw, that it was the measurement that simulates all these guys has the feature that if I multiply all their outcomes together, I get negative 1. So that's what this, oops, that's strange. PowerPoint just crashed. All right. Second. I forgot to close all the extra PowerPoint windows I had open. This one. All right. So given that how we've defined this operational theory, if you jointly measure these three measurements and you get outcomes, which I'll call now M11, M12, M13, those are just variables for the outcomes, you'll find some probability distribution over the 8 possible values of those guys. But it'll only have support on triples of values that have this feature, that when I take their product, I get +1. Similarly for these three and the columns. And then for this third row, the triple of values will have the value -1. OK. We already saw that we don't get deterministic assignments. So I can't, if I assign +1s to all of these guys, there's nothing I can assign to him to get this. But if I allow indeterministic assignments, then I can do it. So this is like the 18-ray example I gave you, where indeterministic assignments can be done non-contextually. This is for Perez-Merman. So let's go through it. So first of all, I'm not just assigning values anymore to these measurements. I'm assigning probability distributions over values. So that's why I've sort of changed, I've got this funny square bracket notation. So what that strictly means is the probability distribution that is a Kronecker delta, you know, outcome M is equal to +1. That's what this means. But for these guys here, I have something different. So this pair, for instance, if I do these three measurements jointly, what I get is a joint probability distribution over the three outcomes, which is Kronecker delta on +1 for this guy, but this correlated distribution on these two guys. So with probability half, they both take the value plus. With probability half, they both take the value minus. So if I look at just the probability distribution on this guy alone, so I marginalize over M12 and M32, what do I get? I get a probability distribution that's a half plus and a half minus. If I look at this measurement here, and I say, what joint distribution do I get over these three outcomes? It's a Kronecker delta on +1 here, and perfect correlation between the outcomes of these two guys, which are right this way. And again, if I take the marginal on him alone, I get with probability half, it'll be outcome plus. With probability half, it'll be outcome minus. So I've satisfied the constraint of measurement non-contextuality. It said, this measurement should get the same response function, whether it's measured in this context or this context. And sure enough, it does. It says, I give a random outcome for the ontic state. My response function is just a probability half of generating plus and a probability half of generating minus. So if I do this, then I can set up, for example, this assignment where everything, you know, these three are positively correlated, this one's negatively correlated, and that way I achieve the fact that the whatever outcome I happen to get, the product of the three outcomes along here is -1. So for example, with probability half, I'll see that it's plus minus, so that product is -1. With probability half, it's plus and then minus plus. Again, the product is -1. And every other constraint is satisfied. Like if I do this row, whatever a random set of outcomes I get, which in this case could be plus on the first and then plus and minus, that product is +1. Or plus on the first and minus minus, that product is also +1. So I satisfy all the constraints in a non-contextual way by allowing for these indeterministic assignments. If I just look at the expectation value of these variables, so remember they're all plus or minus one valued, well then the fact that they're random here means the expectation values here go to 0. So that's the difference from when we required them to have deterministic values. Now the expectation values can be 0. All right, and now to finish the proof, I need to talk about the sources. I want some sources to meet these measurements. And now it's going to look exactly the same. I'm going to have sources, 9 sources that are also associated with these 9 observables. So what I mean by that is imagine a source that prepares, for example, with probability half, the +1 eigenstate of this observable. And with probability half, it prepares the -1 eigenstate of this observable. And similarly, there's a source that with probability half prepares the +1 eigenstate of this observable, with probability half the -1 eigenstate, and so on. So I can think of these 9 binary outcome sources. The eigenspaces of each of them, because they're all on 2 qubits, they're all 2-dimensional eigenspaces. So it's really a sort of 4-dimensional space, and I'm preparing mixed states on each of these 2-dimensional subspaces. And then also note that if you take the average preparation associated with any one of these sources, it always comes down to the completely mixed state. So they all correspond to, when you don't register the outcome, just preparing the completely mixed state. And now it turns out that they also have compatibility relations. So let me tell you exactly what I mean by compatibility relations for sources. It's exactly the same. You know, if I have a source S1 and a source S2, and I say, are they compatible? You just say, well, is there some third source which I can coarse grain in one of two different ways to generate each of these sources? So in, you know, this example, is there a source which I can coarse grain to generate this guy and this guy? Yes, it's the source that prepares with probability a quarter each of the four joint eigenstates of x on the first qubit and x on the second qubit. So they're, you know, x up, x up, x down, x up, x up, x down, x down, x down. That's a four outcome source. If I coarse grain it into the first two outcomes and the second two outcomes, I get this source. Otherwise, if I coarse grain it the other way, I got that source. So yeah, I have a notion of compatibility, just like I did for the measurements. Okay, so, and then when I look at, you know, what is the products of the outcomes of these sources, they have exactly the same sort of pattern that I had for the measurements. Okay, so now we're just repeating everything we did for the measurements, but now for the sources. So this is the same figure you saw before, but now the output aperture is just on the right-hand side of these boxes to denote, these are all sources now. I have 9 sources, they're compatible in all the rows and the columns. And I have one extra equivalence, which is that they all average to the same thing. That's going to be critical. Okay, so remember, we said that extra thing, that by preparation on contextuality, the distribution associated with every one of these sources is going to be the same, regardless of which of the 9 sources I talk about when I average over the outcome. And so this is what we saw in a few slides back, that the correlations between the outcome of the source and the outcome of the measurement is given by this formula, which we can manipulate into this formula, use the fact that it doesn't matter which of the 9 sources I'm talking about, it's the same distribution. So we get down to this form. All right, now we're almost done. So we know that if I take any one of these 9 sources and I hook them up to any one of these 9 measurements, this is what the joint probability distribution looks like in the ontological model, where lambda is the ontic state that connects one to the other. We also know that, you know, for particular ontic states, there are non-contextual indeterministic assignments, like the one I showed you. These are the expectation values. You know, +1 for these 5 guys, 0 for these 4. And there's also these assignments, retrodictive assignments to the 9 sources. +1 for these, 0 for these. So now I can calculate the following quantity. This is the thing that's going to appear in my non-contextuality inequality. How correlated are the outcomes of different source measurement pairs which are matched? So I'm only going to take the green source matching the green measurement and the yellow source matching the yellow measurement. So I take those 9 pairings and I ask how well correlated is the outcome of the source with the outcome of the corresponding measurement. So there's going to be an inequality. This expectation value, what is it? It's just the probability in the ontological model multiplied by, you know, this +/-1 valued variable in this guy, summed over these. That's just the definition of an expectation value for the product. And now I can just say, well, what values does this take in the ontological model? So here it is. I plug in the expression I gave you here. And I take this ontological expression for the probabilities, plug it in. You just do a bit of algebra. You remember that, you know, I can talk about expectation values in the ontological model. That's just summing the probabilities of some outcome multiplied by that outcome. Similarly with the measurement outcomes. So you put that all in and you say, ah, this operational correlation will be the correlation that I see for an ontic state lambda distributed over, you know, that for that distribution over lambda, the special one that corresponds to the average preparation for these guys. Okay, so if you say, well, how correlated for this ontic state? I've just given you an example. Here's an ontic state. This is what it predicts for all the measurements, all the sources. How correlated are they going to be in this case? Well, for these 5 cases, like this match and this match, you know, they both get assigned the value +1, so they're perfectly correlated. But for these cases, like the red one, this outcome is random. They're perfectly independent. They're not correlated. So the correlation, the product of expectations, is just zero, because it's zero meets times zero. So for five of these cases, I get correlation one. For four cases, I get correlation zero. So the correlation's at most 5/9. All right, that's the inequality. So to show it always holds, and I haven't shown you this, if you go looking for other indeterministic non-contextual assignments, so other lambdas and other assignments to these guys, you'll find you never do better than this. Like, so there's other patterns of four zeros that could appear here, but you're never going to get more than 5/9 correlation. Okay, sorry, I've gone over. So you can derive an inequality that is basically motivated by the Prez-Mermin construction. Now you have to use the preparations in a non-trivial way and assume preparation non-contextuality. But because the quantum case would tell me that I expect perfect correlation, right? So this is just preparing the eigenstates of this observable and then measuring which eigenspace I'm in. Obviously, those are going to be perfectly correlated. This is going to, the outcome of this source is going to be perfectly correlated with the outcome of this source. So on average, they'll be perfectly correlated. That violates the 5/9 inequality. Now here's the bottom line. I didn't need to assume the projective measurements. If these things were noisy, it's okay, because I've got a lot of room to play with. As long as all these correlations are bigger than 5/9, I'm okay. I've shown that there's no non-contextual model of the experiment. So this is an inequality that you can go to the lab and test with any 9 binary outcome measurements that have the right compatibility relations. And you can prove that the experiment does not admit of a non-contextual model, regardless of whether quantum theory is true or not. I am over time, so I'm going to skip this connection to quasi-probability representations. You can read it on the slides. I mentioned last time that non-locality is a resource. So is the failure of non-contextuality. So you can take a look at these papers if you're interested. So there's cryptographic tasks, computational tasks. It's very similar to what I told you last time. And then I was going to end with explaining a little bit about what the assumption of non-contextuality has in common with Einstein's equivalence principle. I'm going to skip that as well. Okay, to sum up. So in these 8 lectures, we sort of saw all these possible ways of resolving the measurement problem. We focused near the end on approaches that denied that the quantum state was a complete representation of reality. And we showed that there were sort of various ways you could do that. So if psi is incomplete, it could just be like a de Broglie-Bohm theory where there's something else to say, or it could just be describing states of knowledge directly. And I mentioned that sort of the modern discussion of in quantum foundations often focuses on this, is it psi epistemic or psi ontic? You saw some of the senses in which these epistemic models are quite natural, but they cannot reproduce things like contextuality. Well, neither of these guys can reproduce, it can explain the outcomes of experiments in a local or non-contextual way. So it's sort of both the Cauchy-Specker and the Bell theorem are kind of indifferent to this difference. You can think of it this way. Einstein held out hope that maybe if you went over here, you could preserve locality. You might have had hope that maybe if you went over here, you could preserve non-contextuality as well. But no, you can't. So you have to face contextuality and non-locality, regardless of which direction you take. Let me end with that. So, thanks. Tomorrow, it's Lucien's last lecture. Questions? Yeah. Yes.
So these derivations, these bounds, the violation derivations, they all seem to rely on looking at expectation values. Does it make sense to talk about higher order moments, and do you get anything by doing that?
Well, ultimately, using expectation values is just a kind of convenient way of expressing these. At the end of the day, the experimental evidence comes in the form of some joint distribution over the outcomes of these two, you know, the measurement and the source, given the setting of the measurement and the setting of the source. So all the information is that you can't say anything more about your experiment than giving you the full joint distribution. So ultimately, it's that full joint distribution that satisfies certain non-contextuality inequalities. Now, you can, if you want, you can rewrite all the information that's in a joint distribution in terms of expectation values. Like if I have a joint distribution over two binary variables, if you give me the marginal expectation values of each variable and the expectation value of the products of those two variables, so here I'm imagining they're plus or minus one valued, you can recover the joint distribution from all those expectation values. So if you want, you can express the non-contextuality inequalities in terms of expectation values for correlators, expectation values for marginals. It's just another language. The ones I presented here happen to focus in on these particular aspect of the joint probability distribution, which was the expectation value of these correlators, just because it made for sort of a convenient narrative. But you know, ultimately what you want is all the constraints on the full joint distribution. That would tell you precisely the boundary between what can be explained non-contextually and what can't. Any more questions? So let me mention that in tutorial this afternoon, you're going to be working on contextuality, but it's not going to involve anything you saw today. So it's all about the traditional notion of non-contextuality that we saw yesterday. But don't get confused thinking that there's anything that you saw today that's important. It's not for the tutorial.